Oh, yeah, the late ones think they're going to be on the top, right? Okay, so here's the deal. I will shuffle the cards a little bit, mix them up. Okay, there we go. We're going to Gardena together. I like your style. And I will try to respond as briefly as my profession allows and cover as many of these as I can. And if I'm going to duck one absolutely cleanly, I will tell you I'm going to duck it. Who was the greatest UU? We're not a hierarchical organization. Generally, I suspect that with the loose standards that we have for considering who is a Unitarian, I'm not going to do UU because that kind of makes it post-1965 and merger. Somewhere between Thomas Jefferson, who was not a card carrier but a fellow traveler, and Isaac Newton, we probably had some fairly decent IQ points in there. However, greatness more often manifests itself, in my view, in acts of quiet and sometimes private courage. And without sounding too preachy about it, although that is an occupational hazard, I'm not sure that there weren't two members of Studio City that I knew about who had relatively limited incomes, who adopted three special needs children, and raised them without anybody really knowing that they were adopted, and without any distinction between the adopted children and their own biological children. And they were heroes. They were really heroes for what they did with their lives. And I think that that's where greatness really manifests itself. How can a person maintain polite objectivity and continue a polite discussion when one believes our current government has lost all reason and is embattled on a course that will lead to disaster? Well, objectivity is not anything that anyone should pretend to. We have feelings and we have passions on every side of every issue. And to speak one's own sense of truth with passion and integrity is a virtue. To speak it in such a way that you close the ears of the people that you are talking to, I think that becomes the critical issue. When we are involved in a discussion or a debate or an argument, it seems to me that the first thing that people need to do is to choose what is the outcome that we want from this particular exchange. Do I want to win on points? Do I want to humiliate the adversary? Do I want to open up their ears and their hearts to my point of view so that they can at least hear me? And it's very important that the speakers and the listeners know what their objective is. I think a lot of us, just on the domestic and on the home front, sometimes lose track of this and kind of model it in the microcosm about winning instead of about connecting. And so you speak your truth, but speak it in a way that is not self-indulgent unless you just want to blow off steam. If you want to communicate, then you change the objective of the conversation. But I don't think we have to pretend to objectivity. Beside living in the best manner I can, is there a way to make the world a better, more loving place? Well, it's looking at what is best in how we live our lives with each other, whether it's referring to my friends who had adopted, whether it is trying to have exchanges with people where we make a difference. The great problem in life, and life is an incomplete information problem, which is we don't have complete information in making our choices about how to live. We don't know what the outcomes are going to be. And we don't know which of our actions and activities are going to make the difference to another person or to other people and eventually to the world. And so we are stuck with doing the best that we can, following our own lights, subject to information and feedback from other people, and trying to make the good small differences that we can. The great grand messianic visions and the utopian visions usually are not as effective as regular people doing small things. I may butcher this quote, but I think Mother Teresa said something about miracles are accomplished not by doing great things, but by doing small things with great love. And I think that those are wonderful and inspirational words. We should, is there a question here? I'll make it this. Should we consider limiting the time that a person talks during the talk back to a maximum of 3 minutes? And it's not clear whether I'm included in this. We should consider everything. Whoa. Good point. Remind the UU community again. Being UUs, I thought to question was the answer. Apparently to state is the answer. Okay. Remind the UU community again that we should accord inherent worth and dignity to the current occupant of the White House, who regularly disassembles the truth before the American people and is responsible for the death of thousands of people in the name of corporate greed. Whoa, talk about a mixed message and the end of the sentence not following the beginning. Oh, why we? I'm sorry, I missed a word. Why we should accord worth and dignity? You know, you hate because ad hominem arguments aren't good things to do. To argue against the man leaves it open for exactly what the other side did against Clinton, the man. You talk about the acts. You deal with the worth and dignity of a human being who may be sincere, may not be sincere, and frankly, when I look at politicians, I don't know whether I want sincere zealots or I want flexible opportunists. It's easier to negotiate with opportunists. So watch out what you look for and what you wish for. But that is not to judge the heart of the other person. It's to judge the actions. And you can find actions despicable and not have to demean the other person because it's not a productive engagement. Now, it's true that this government does that, and actually almost all American governments have, with just remarkable coincidence, diagnosed the leaders of whoever the opposition to America might be as being mentally ill and perverts and all kinds of wonderful things. These are not effective arguments, and they don't move the cause that you want to advocate. There's a certain theme today. Is there any way to really get past the human tendency to see things in terms of us and them, so that this is the root of conflict? Yeah, but not on purpose. Our reflex is to catch. Our reflex is to see us and them. It takes an act of will to step back from that instinct of we're the good guys, they're the bad guys, and we have nothing in common. We don't create a more peaceful world by seeing things in yet blacker and whiter ways. When we complain, whatever side we may be on, that the other side demonizes the opposition, and then we respond by demonizing our opposition, the game isn't advanced, and the possibilities of reconciliation or of at least approach so that we can get close enough to talk and don't have to shout at each other, is increased when we hold off on our very human way of dividing the world into us and them. It's important to remember that the us and the them is almost always a flexible category. It's the us and the them on a political, it's the us and the them on this issue, or on a race issue, or an economic issue, or on a religious issue, or a philosophical issue. There are lots of different combinations of us and them. So that when we are vehement in the us and them moment, we are burning the bridges that we have with people who are allied with us on other events. One of the stories that I love to tell, because it's true, is back in the late 60s when my friend Hans, Father Hans, a Franciscan friar, and I used to regularly drive across the Bay Bridge to go to demonstrations in San Francisco. When it was on politics in Latin America, we marched together. When it was on birth control, we marched against each other. We had lunch in between and drove both ways with each other. It's important to be able to do that with each other, because I think it was Barry Goldwater who said, nobody agrees with anybody about everything. Source of all, a phrase in the first hymn. What is, are, oh, that's good, your personal sources for inspiration and guidance? You know, the hymns were wonderful today, because we had Lord of all replaced by source of all, because Lord sounds just so masculine. And the second one was full of God, so I was kind of figuring that we would have something like this. There are so many sources of wisdom and of inspiration available to all of us. One of the great things about Unitarian Universalists in not having to take any religion literally, but to look at all religions respectfully, is that we can pick and choose various sources. A Sufi story, a Hasidic story, the Psalms, the moment on Good Friday, the teachings of the Buddha. There are so many sources of inspiration from religion. There are also sources, personally for me, of music, actually Bach being my favorite, where the music plays and I close my eyes and I feel myself washed over with peace and calm that allows me to get the energy to re-engage the world. There are the inspirations of decent people acting kindly to each other, and the love that from time to time we human beings show each other as family, as community, and even occasionally and most inspirationally to the stranger amongst us. I think that's not a censor, that's a asked and answered. Can you give some examples of a few impertinent type questions you have received in the past beside this one? No. Because you'll want me to answer them, I know that. When can we expect Armageddon? Well, I think that's what the opening poem was about. Talmud says that if you save the life of one person, you save the world. Armageddon comes every day to millions of people around the world, and Armageddon is preventable in the individual and the specific, up to a point, obviously, since we are mortal, and it is preventable up to the moment that our son Novus. We don't need to see it, just as we don't need to see decency as something messianic and universal, but the universal in the particular act of saving people. One of the great conflicts in religious history has been between those who wanted to save souls and those who wanted to save bodies. Your soul is your business to Unitarian Universalists. Your body, not in the Supreme Court sense, but your body, its right to health, its right to food, its right to be treated with dignity, is everyone's business. Unitarians have been with the American journey since its inception. Christians still predominate. Why are we only 0.2% of the population? Why doesn't our chalice light up the whole continent? Well, from time to time, it does light up the whole continent, and it lit up the 20th century because it's not about numbers, and it's not about our denomination being better than any other denomination. It is about Unitarian Universalists and our thought and thoughtful processes of engaging the world being hugely influential in philosophy and education and in government. Hugely disproportionately represented in American presidency for our numbers. Hugely disproportionately represented in terms of the great intellectuals, the men and women who made the real differences in the 20th century. From Dewey to, not the Dewey that ran for president, but from Dewey to Horace Mann, from Emerson to Thoreau, to Elliot Richardson in the Nixon administration and Adlai Stevenson. At one point in the 60s, we had over 30 people in the Congress and the Senate of the United States for 0.2%. That's remarkable. Is the entire world going to convert to one style of worship? No, and shouldn't. If I tried to get, well, God knows if I tried, if somebody competent tried to get you singing ecstatically and showing huge emotion, we'd be empty. There are different styles and different cuisines and different ways that people choose to be together. This is one, not better necessarily than another, in terms of where we get our source of inspiration and our sense of community. So I think we cast quite a light for our size, and I'm not particularly troubled by our size. We still have a critical mass. We believe in separation of church and state, yet we are frequently addressing political issues. Is this a conflict? No. I may have a strange reading of the Constitution, but it's mine and I'm going to keep it until you talk me out of it. The founders wanted to separate church and state so that the state would not own the church and act under cover of religion, which it is tempted to do all of the time. It never meant that religious people should not try to have their values consecrated in law, so that whether we are talking about the civil rights movement, the anti-abolition movement, the great movements for unions in the 19th century, for workers' rights and women's rights and minority rights in the 20th century, these have been religious moral visions that individuals have tried to make into law because they believed it to be inherently correct. The laws should not be rationalized by the government, however, as religion. But the religious certainly have a right to petition the government and to work with or against the government according to our individual religious views and sources of inspiration. I don't see a conflict except that there is an inherent tension always between religion and state because they both want to deal with how human beings should live together in community. I've rejected personally the notion of a personal God. However, I am not sure about the notion of a creator. What am I? Why do we need labels? I was expecting a couple of God questions. I wonder at existence. Existence is just remarkable. when we read physics, when we read philosophy, when we read religion, they all go back to a point beyond which we cannot penetrate. And that is, why is there something when presumably there could be nothing? How is it that we, thought and action and desires and physicality, came out of that one moment, so far as we know, of creation where everything sprang from an ultra-concentrated singularity? Why, where, how, I don't know. That explosion and that mass gave birth to hydrogen, to helium, to heavy metal elements that somehow became life, if you are not blown away in wonder and awe, I think you're not paying attention. I don't find a conflict between being religious and either having or not having a personal God. I don't find a conflict between religion and science. They look at things differently, but equally validly. When I was being interviewed once for actually the fellowship committee, they asked if I believed in God. And without being overly Clintonian, because I didn't have that word back then, I said, I don't think it's an important question. I believe that life has meaning, that it is wonderful, and we have time to appreciate it, to make a difference, to create love where we can and peace where we can, and to celebrate that insight is to me what is deeply religious and spiritual. I think from the hardest core atheist who is secure in the belief that there is no God, whatever that word God means, and it's got a plethora of meanings, to the most convicted theist, there is more bridging us than we imagine, because both would agree that what we choose and what we do in this life at least makes a difference. When there is no other hand, although we must be open-minded and tolerant of other points of view, when can we consider these wrong or evil and in the need of redress? Well, when you see them as wrong and evil in need of redress. Being tolerant is of a person, not of an act. There have been all kinds of times in my life when I've run across people who are capable of evil or who've done evil, possibly even when I look in the mirror and shave, capable of evil. Not in that moment, but when I see my reflection, I know in my own humanity, and I get into trouble for saying this, but there's no genetic difference between my family at Auschwitz and the guards at Auschwitz. We're the same humanity subject to different environments and different pieces of influence. People are good or bad environmentally and sometimes personally, but all human beings, as far as I know, are capable of being at times stampeded by those flight and fight hormones, by being panicked by fear, by doing something evil. It exists in the world, and sometimes it exists when ordinary people do bad things, and sometimes it exists when ordinary people don't do the good things. As the philosopher said, all that is needed for the triumph of evil is that for a few good people to remain silent. It is a very tough world, and we need to redress the evils that we see, but in ways that are not themselves evil. Because I think it's very important to remember that sincerity is not the mark of goodness. People who walk into markets with bombs strapped on them are sincere. John Wilkes Booth was sincere. Sincerity does not buy you much. The actions are what are important in the consideration that we have of other human beings in our world. Regarding the stone tablets in the Alabama courthouse, are the Orthodox Jews offended at this biblical ignorance? The Ten Commandments written in stone are in Exodus 34, not in Exodus 20. Here's the problem with the Ten Commandments. They're not up there. Or the Ten Suggestions. Nobody agrees what they say. The Ten Commandments of Judaism are different from of Christianity slightly. The whole graven image thing gets lost in Christianity. And if you look around the sanctuary, sometimes seems to get lost in Judaism also. They're not inherently dangerous, but they don't necessarily say what you think that they say. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not murder. And that gives human beings plenty of room for interpretation of what is killing, what is manslaughter, what is execution, and what is justice. And we won't even get to the adultery one, which doesn't mean what you think it means either.
Actually, Exodus 34 is totally different.
They are two different readings of the Decalogue. That's right.
Don't spoil a goat in its mother's milk. Talking about breaking a donkey's neck. It's ridiculous.
Well, I'll talk about the goats. It's if there's a dishes question, because what happens that particular passage when you go on to everything that's explained. Seize not the kid in the milk of its mother leads my wife to have six sets of dishes, because you're not supposed to have meat and milk on the same plate, and sometimes you're not allowed to, and you can't have them at the same meal, and some people have separate refrigerators and dishwashers. And I don't think that on Sinai they were actually contemplating whether it should be a Fisher Paykel or a Bosch, but it seems somehow to go there. And it came from the idea of the wall around the Torah, which is interpretation. Seethe not the kid in the milk of its mother was about animal rights and human rights. It said even an animal, you wouldn't do anything so hideously ironic and cruel as to cook the baby in the milk of its mother. And if you show that kind of consideration for a goat, your responsibility is so much higher for a human being. But human beings then turned it into the Porcelain Creation Subsidy Act. Okay, that wasn't asked and answered. Oh, God, if you're giving the last sermon of your life, not only is the congregation there, but your family, closest friends, what would be your main message? Life has been good. Love one another. You know, standing on one foot as the sage, it really does come down to what we do with each other and how we respect the joys and challenges in our own lives and how we fall short and how we allow others to help us when we stumble, and how in turn we help them and keep doing it better and try to be kinder and nicer to each other tomorrow than you were today. Don't beat yourself up over today, but we all have a distance to go in soothing our hearts. Depends on how you mean it. Because there's a question of interpretation, and I'm not willing to make the interpretation publicly. Trust me. Well, why should you? Okay. The federal government has promised to dispose of nuclear waste. This has now become a worrisome problem in many areas, you think? What can we do as a church? Isn't the global environment a major moral concern? That's such an interesting question, in that I don't have the technical expertise, and people I respect are on both sides of the nuclear argument. I know very green people who say we have to do nuclear energy if we want to get rid of our dependence on carbon-based fuels and just trust that we're going to come up with a good disposal mechanism, and other people that say stop it dead in its tracks, which in this country we pretty much have. And I got to tell you, clearly the disposal issue has not been solved, but I don't know what the ultimate outcome is on this. And it's like so many ballot propositions that are technical, that I try to do good research and hear people on all sides, and in the end, I end up going, I'm really not sure about this, but I have to make a choice. At this point in technology, we have not aced the issue of the safe disposal of nuclear waste, in my view, but it doesn't mean that we won't. But it is certainly an issue that people ought to be involved in, and it is so interesting that the federal government, this federal government that believes in states' rights unless it's inconvenient, is literally railroading its nuclear waste on a very railroaded Nevada. Why should I believe? Believe what? I don't know. How can I not believe in life? How can I not believe in beauty? How can I, with, I want to go into a Hamlet soliloquy, how can I not believe in the wonder of life? Now, everyone, hardcore atheist to hardcore theist, is spiritual whether you use the word or not. And by that, I mean we have needs that are beyond three hots and a cot. We would not be happy living in cells, even with our loved ones, in a constant environment, guaranteed a secure bed and three meals of gruel. We need seasoning. We need color. We need to be needed by a world. We need art on our walls. We have all kinds of needs that go beyond the material. There is a floor of material comfort that human beings deserve, but what we need for ourselves to grow are challenges, and meaning some things that are ugly, and beauty, and things that we want to do to our world and our environment with and for each other. I have in my family born-again Christians. They, of course, believe in creationism. In order to keep family peace, I have to bite my tongue in many ways. How can we bridge that gap and come to a satisfactory understanding of one another? Depends on what you mean by satisfactory. The issue really is people who are comfortable with many forms of poetry and people for whom there's only one poem. And if you can appreciate their poem, it is one step. If you say their poem is wrong, just as most of us said to our children or grandchildren, your music is wrong, again, it's burning bridges. You have to understand that people who only have one poem or one form of music will not appreciate ours. But I think that the most important thing in and your tagline of the coming Fullerton Observer column is that if you want to evangelize, whether religiously or politically, you have to lead your life in a way that makes your life and your way compelling. It won't be done by shouting. It won't be done by arguing. And it might not even be done by logic. I can bridge the creation gap logically, but that's not what the creationist intelligent design person is looking for. They're looking for, is it true or is it false? Not the more complex issue. So I try to be respectful of other people's poetry and time needs as we get down to the end. I think I answered that one. John, you're our UU minister, but I notice that you're not a member of the UU Church in Fullerton. I wonder if there's a reason for that. Yeah, somebody would pledge me. No, I shouldn't have a vote. What you get as a member, I get everything a member gets, but a vote, and I shouldn't have a vote. Actually, I'm not an employee. I don't work for the church. I work with the church as an independent contractor, if there are any enrolled agents here. I have a friend who just heard from his doctor that he will die soon. He says he wants to come over to discuss it. Any thoughts about how I can approach this topic and help him? Tell your truth. You know, everybody here lives with an indefinite death sentence. Most of the time, we engage in denial, and that helps us get through the day. But when denial becomes less and less possible, people accept their finitude. Death is not always the ultimate adversary. Truth, intimacy, connection with the people whom we love is a very precious gift. If someone is dying, one of the things that we learn as human beings is we don't solve every problem, and all we can do is keep each other good company. And one of the tragedies, the worst deaths that I've seen have been the pretends. People who say, well, you're looking much better today, and you're going to get up soon, and you're going to lick this thing, and the other person says, yeah, I know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And what happens is there's never the moment of connection where you get to say to each other, God, I love you, and if anything happens or when something happens, there's going to be a chunk of my heart and my life that is gone. What we say to people who are dying is not a magic formula that takes away fear. It's simply, I am here to be with you and for you and to give you what you need. They ask questions about you. Give your own answers. They don't have to be definitive. You don't have to be right. But it is an incredibly, extraordinarily intimate relationship that needs, I believe, to be done with truth and with integrity and not simply with formulas and blessings and prayers. The blessings that we give each other, the greatest gifts that we give each other, to each other, to our parents, to our children, to our family, is our presence, our active presence, and sometimes just our silence and holding a hand and trying to respond honestly. I think we've come to just about the last one. Wedding and funeral questions. You know, so infrequently do strange and wonderful things happen at weddings or funerals. They usually go pretty much the way they're planned, but I guess there are a couple of exceptions. I guess my favorite wedding story was the wedding where the marriage didn't survive the reception. And that is one of the things about premarital counseling. You can't pick up fraud. The gentleman had three children by a previous. The bride had two children by a previous. It was a home wedding. Nobody here, by the way. And two congregations ago. And they didn't follow my instructions. They didn't take the telephone off the hook. They didn't lock up the animals. And so in the middle of the wedding, the phone rings, the dog mounts the bride's leg, a baby starts crying. It's the only time in my entire career that I've ever lost my professional cool and actually giggled. But that isn't what ruined it. After the ceremony, the groom said, by the way, honey, I signed a teaching contract for 2 years in the Marshall Islands. Take good care of the kids. She suggested several anatomically difficult things he could do with himself on the way to the Marshall Islands. Asked me if I would tear up the certificate, which I couldn't. But I said, boy, do you have room for an annulment tomorrow when you go down to the City Hall in Oakland. So that was one wedding story. And the other one's yesterday. I had two weddings yesterday, and one beautiful, perfect wedding out in Malibu, and the surf was beautiful, the birds were beautiful, the bride was beautiful, the groom was crying and completely emotional. It was wonderful. And then we're roaring over the canyon to get to my wife's cousin's Mike's wedding. We had done the rehearsal a week ago, and Mike and Lisa were all excited. And we got the call that Lisa was going to the hospital and that she was in the hotel. And would I please come to the hotel to marry them? And she is laying in bed like this, possible kidney stone. I've had a kidney stone, incidentally. So I had a tremendous amount of compassion for her. When my renal colic hit, I was on the second floor of a building in Vienna, and it was a good thing, because if I had been on the fifth floor, I would have been out the window. But on the second floor, I knew I'd only get a broken leg, which wouldn't hurt as much as the kidney, the renal colic. So I had the groom get in bed with her, and believe me, it wasn't a first. And I mean, I have had brides pass out from holding their breath. I've had brides pass out from not eating for 2 weeks because they needed to lose that extra 15 pounds that they promised that they would lose when they bought the dress instead of the 10 pounds that they gained after they bought the dress. And that's a turnaround of about 25 pounds. I've had them sick as dogs with morning sickness, of course. I've had a couple in labor, but I've never actually married one in bed. So yesterday was a first, and it will go into my my book, because it was really nice, because I didn't have to ask that critical question. In sickness and in health. Because that they were there and saying, I do to each other, proved the point. And essentially, given the themes that we've done today, about what is religion and what is goodness and what is social responsibility and how should we be in this world religiously and politically, it is to try to be with people who are the same and people who are different in joy and in sorrow, in sickness and in health, for richer and for poorer, to know the inherent dignity that human beings are worth even when we disagree with them and their acts. As the Orthodox religious say, to hate the sin and not the sinner, and to be together and grow together as individuals, as human beings, as families, and as communities. Unitarian Universalists are not about what we say we believe. We are about what we do. Service to each other and to humanity is our prayer, and it is in our actions that we manifest our religion, not by how loudly we shout our beliefs.